Hello, friends, fans, and followers. Matt with Tales on Trails Deer Tracking. We are back with part two of the Trackers Forum. We're less two trackers from last time. Life happens, man, but we will take what we can get, and it will not detract from the quality of this conversation, I can tell you that. We have some topics lined up that I think are going to be fun. And as usual, there's not going to be near enough time to cover them in the depth that we all want to as trackers who love to talk about tracking. But we're going to give it our best, and we're going to cover some ground. We had some nice feedback from part one, and I'm looking forward to part two. We've been our text thread all week has been a lot of fun and exciting, and all kinds of topics coming up. And I think there's going to be some spin-off podcasts from this one. So who's missing today? Matt Davis from Broken Arrow is out of Missouri is missing. And then Jeremiah Gracie from Gracie's Tracking Service in Vermont. I wasn't able to join us today. They could each join us later. I told them, look, guys, don't hesitate if you join late. That's okay, man. We're going to be here a while. So we welcome their experience and their feedback and their good topics. So with us is, and I'm just going to go as you're laid out on my screen here as in the Brady Bunch of Hollywood Squares looking form, is to my right is Nick Berge from Wounded White, West Michigan. What is it, Nick?
What? Yours Wounded White Pills, Tracking and Recovery?
Yeah, man, I don't know what it is about yours. It always ties my tongue. Wounded Whitetails Tracking Recovery out of Michigan, southern lower peninsula of Michigan. Also with us returning is Mitch and Carrie Hummel out of Oklahoma with C&M Tracking.
Big Game. Go ahead, Tracking Carrie. And Recovery.
Yeah, see, I need to have it in front of me. And then Dave Medora is also with us from Albany, New York. D&W, what, Dave?
That's it. You got it. Tracking. D&W Tracking Big Game Recovery, right? So.
There you go. A lot of words. Nothing like Tales on Trails Deer Tracking. See how mine's all sing-songy and stuff? No, I'm just kidding. So, guys, thanks for coming back, man. This is a lot of fun. I've been looking forward to this one. You know, and I've enjoyed our text conversation outside of the recording in the public forum. So, you know, what I want to do, let's just pick up where we left off on the last podcast. And I think we left on part one with Nick talking about, you know, his recommendation. I think Dave said, hey, what tip or trick would you have? And we went around the horn and we ended with Nick saying, you know, just trust your dog. You've got to trust your dog. And trust your dog has been something that's been very, I don't want to put this, but it's something I have battled as a new tracker. And by the way, it's not unique to me, but I, you know, in my isolated little world, in the heat of the moment, you feel like you're the only one that has this problem. So I want to frame this, and I just kind of want to talk a little bit about where I'm coming from when you say trust your dog, what it means to me, and the reason why, even in my second year, I've still had a pretty notable, particularly the first half of the season, a pretty notable skepticism when it comes to tracking, and I'll explain why. So I do believe trust your dog. You have got to trust your dog, like we talked about in part one. You know, my UBT test judge says the person is the weakest link, 100% true. But, you know, so you have to trust your dog. But I don't – my take on this is it's not a blind trust. It is not a blind trust for your dog. It's trust that is gained by the time behind your dog in training tracks and learning to read your dog. And what I'm finding out, too – a whole learning to read your dog is not something you pick up in your first year on 42 tracks. that is evolution that is constantly ongoing, because there's I've come to believe, even Dave, our senior tracker here at 6 years, excuse me, there's probably subtle nuances in Winston that maybe you hadn't noticed before, or you still don't notice today, or maybe you've got it down. But, you know, we don't know what a dog is thinking. We don't know what a dog is, you know, truly what's going on in their mind and all of the things that they're really smelling. So, you know, if we're not always, I've come to learn, if we're not always approaching every single track and every, you know, whether it's a practice line or a real line with, okay, what did I learn from this one? What can I learn from this one? You know, how is this one different from the last one? That constant after action review and comparison, which, by the way, if your mind is hyperactive like mine, it can get you in a lot of trouble. Excuse me. But you know, we should always be looking to find that next little morsel, that next, what did that head tilt mean? What did that head snap mean? What did that double circle mean? You know, whatever that case may be. So yes, trust your dog, but not blind trust, because you've got to know when your dog is, you know, as they say, trashing on something or off, you know, the tracking demeanor has changed just subtly enough to where you don't think it's tracking the deer that we're after anymore. So trust your dog 100%, Nick. I'm totally with you. Now, let me tell you how that has gotten me in has caused some pause for me. And I'll give you three scenarios, maybe two, when it comes to trusting your dog. So first of all, here in Southern Michigan, we have a lot of cornfields. And what I found out last year is cornfields suck. They can kind of be kryptonite for dogs, you know, and I didn't really have that awareness my first year. We hadn't really been talked about with my mentors or amongst my tracking group much until I really got caught in a cornfield on what was supposed to be an easy track. And I lost my ever-loving mind because we couldn't find this deer. My dog was losing her mind. I had a guy come in behind me and we think it got pushed by coyotes. And that's because his dog tracked very similar to mine and kind of went helter-skelter in the cornfield. He said, I was at night, he was during the day, and he could see where the corn was all trashed down where he thinks the deer was being. I'm like, okay. Well, boy, that would have been nice to have that clarity in my mind that night. But my point is, you know, and that's when my mentor said, oh, cornfield, yeah, you're doomed, you know. And so a follow-up track to that was on a deer for somebody that I'd tracked for before. And he's a young kid, local. In fact, I coached him in football when he was young. And I recover his deer earlier in the year. He managed the track absolutely perfectly both times. When I tracked his, he says, Matt, a shine load, what do I do? I says, sit there as long as you can. Get out of there. Don't do anything. We found his deer in 6 minutes at 293 yards or something. Man is perfect. So when his girlfriend made a bad shot out of the same stand on a deer, he did the same thing. So it should have been a slam dunk track, except for this time his deer went into the cornfield. So we go into the cornfield. She's tracking along. And I think I did a restart or two, you know, and there really wasn't any blood. And I got to trust the dog, got to trust the dog, got to trust the dog. Next thing I know, I am 400 yards away by the road. Because I'm trusting my dog. She's moving. She's tracking something. So I'm following her because I'm trusting my dog. When the hunter comes on the radio, Matt, we got the deer right here. I'm like, what? He said, yeah, it's right here. I'm like, holy crap. So I make the 400-yard trek back. And what had happened was she missed the turn. They said, you know, we were tracking along. We were on the line. The deer made a left turn down the cornfield. Brew missed that turn, and when she missed that turn, she went and found something else she liked and was tracking it, and I followed her. If I had looked to my left, I might have seen it down there 20 or 30 yards. So I gave her credit for the recovery because she did lead us there. I mean, you could see my boot prints. They said, no, Matt, you were right here, and I realized we just missed the turn. But because I trusted my dog, I was 400 yards down the corner at the road when I said, hey, man, you know, and then they say, well, you know, so that's one scenario. Another scenario is on a deer, you know, another recovery, you know, the hunter, again, remember we talked about hunters being the worst witnesses, you know, so I'm always, okay, yeah, that's what you think you saw, but, you know, I don't want to say I take it with a grain of salt, but I always, okay. You know, I take the hunter scenario and at least use it in very general, broad terms. And at least, you know, the deer went that away, you know. I won't give him the detail. Went behind this tree, and then it went up that hill. And I'm like, oh, you just don't went this way. So we're tracking. We start the deer or start the track. And I can't remember. It was probably 20, 24 hours old, something like that. We start the track, she goes up the hill and generally in the general direction that the hunter said that he saw the deer. Now the hunter thought the deer was down the ridge and around. I'm like, well, you don't know, you know, maybe it was up here, because then he started to second guess. So we were up on that ridge. The dog took us across the field into the southern wood lot and tracked to a gut pile. I'm like, oh no, you know. So the hunter comes over and we're hem-hawing around and thinking, you know, so we go back, start again. The Beru takes the exact same line, goes up, you know, and this took longer than I'm making it sound, but it, you know, this is the Reader's Digest version. She goes up, she took the exact same damn line across that same spot in and went back to that gut pile. I'm like, gosh, dang it, man, that might be your deer. Because it was on a neighbor's property and somebody else was hunting it. And we started examining the gut pile. Oh, look, yeah, there might be a hole in that gut right there where he thought he hit it. So I'm like, gosh, dang it, man. I think this could be your deer. I mean, the dog led us here twice. And he says, well, do you mind if we go back just one more time? I go, absolutely not. Let's go. We're here. Let's go one more time. So we went back there and started the dog. And, you know, my intent was this time was to, you know, maybe, I don't want to say force the dog, but, you know, steer her more where the hunter thought he saw the deer go. So we went back and started her again. And she goes, she buries her nose in the leaves. And I said, hey, look right there. See what's there. He rummaged around and finally saw a tiny spot of blood. So I'm like, okay, cool. So we let her go, and she stayed now more where the hunter said he thought he saw the deer. We went into this weeds, and she got in the scent pooling around, and I'll be damned, there was the deer, you know, 80, 100 yards away. So that deer died within sight of the hunter's tree stand, probably 150 yards, you know, as the crow flies to the tree stand. It was more distance as he went around, but my dog took me on what I call a goose chase twice to the same spot. You know, I'm like, what the hell? So that, what does that do? That breeds doubt. That bred doubt for me. So yeah, I got to trust my dog, but she's OP. She proved me wrong. She took me to the wrong spot twice with confidence. So I'm like, what do I make of this? You know, oh, and by the way, going into the season, she had this tendency. I almost quit all off-season training because I was becoming so frustrated, because she would grab these hot lines. I would lay, you know, my scent line. She would get on a hot line and off she'd go. And I'd have to come, and I know she's off now. So I'm like, this is doing me no good. Because all it is doing is creating doubt for me. It's not helping us. It's creating doubt, which doubt is a bad thing when you're on in the real world. So, you know, that is the struggle that I had when it comes to trust your dog. Now, I can tell you that, you know, now that I kind of know she's good for at least one goose chase forever on every track, it seems. You know, I'm learning that now, and maybe, you know, and as she's getting older and I'm getting more experience behind her and we're getting better in tune with each other, I'll say, you know, maybe I'll start picking up on those subtleties that, you know, that will tell me whether she's on our target deer or not, you know, because the problem I got with this young bloodhound is she tracks with the same confidence, the wrong line as she does the target line. And the funny thing is another young tracker in our network, he has two bloodhounds, and he and I are about, he has far more tracks than me because his job allows him to be just track all he wants during the season. So, but as far as years and age of our dog, we're almost exactly the same. And he's having the same issues with his bloodhound. So, you know, I'm hoping it's a maturity thing. I did start to see some improvement, whether that was improvement in the dog or the improvement of my ability to read the dog or a combination of the two. But I did see later in the season improvement. So forgive me for monopolizing the conversation here, but that's I've just been dying to get this out to other trackers and you know, when we talk about trusting the dog in doubt, that is just a real world scenario that I've had, and I think we're going to train through it, and I think we're starting to break through it. So, you know, on that perspective, you know, what would you guys say based on you know, my scenario when it comes to trusting the dog? Anybody else have experiences like that? Or how did you train through it? How did you overcome it? Have you overcome it? Maybe you haven't seen it. What do you guys think?
I'll go if you don't mind.
Yeah.
I don't have a bloodhound, right? A little 27 pound little dog, right? But to me, I experienced the same thing with my dog, right? Like, I didn't know what I was doing. I think one of the other topics we're going to talk about is how you ended up with the dog you have.
Yep.
So I'll save that story, but I didn't know how to track. I didn't know how to train the dog or any of that stuff. Right. So you get out there, and I think we treat our dogs as like they're robots, right? Like a track is a track, like put your nose on the ground and go, right? Like the deer went that way, put your nose on the ground and go. Right. But now hearing you say that your dog tracked to a gut pile that's been sitting there for 2 days out in the sun, right, with the wind blowing in its face, to me is like, good dog, right? Like, is it cheating a little bit, right? Is it cheating because it's like that's a really strong smell and I can just walk there. Like, I don't even need to put my nose on the ground.
Yeah.
Right? I can just go there. Like, if my dog were to do that and I'm asking it to track like a lesser scent, you know, that potentially has only been laying there for 16 hours or something like that, I wouldn't get as frustrated, right? But, right, trusting your dog. I think the other part of it is we fail more than we succeed in general, right? Like this year for me, I was right around 50%, great year. But I think a lot of that is because repeat people that I've met before in the past that have done some things wrong.
They know how to manage a
track. And easy tracks, right? Like they didn't even go look for it. They're like, Dave, I think I got it back. I'm like, leave the goddamn thing. I'm on the way, right? Like easy recovery for us. Another Mark in Italy. Was it a tough track? Could he have found it by himself? Probably, right? But they start to trust you, right? But in general, right? There's a guy, Western New York, Bob Yaks, 1,000 tracks with the same dog, wire-haired dachshund, over 1,000 tracks in 12 years, right? He believes that in New York, 75% of the phone calls that you pick up on are not dead deer. So if you didn't screen for anything, and I think this is more in New York because we don't charge, right?
Right.
You go to Ohio, Iowa, Missouri, right, where it's $300 to show up for maybe for somebody, that rate goes down, right? Like, you're probably not tracking a lot of does at $300 or $400 a clip. But in New York, Bob really believes through his spreadsheet and everything that he's tracked is that if he were to go on every call that he picked up, 75% of those are not a dead deer. So we fail, I'm using air quotes here, more than we succeed. So as the guy at the other end of the leash, if we didn't jump the deer and physically see it leave, you're like, what happened? It's a mystery, right? So it makes it tough to trust your dog. You get back in the truck and you're like, man, that arrow was soaked in blood. Like, how did we not find that deer? Yep. And then 2 months later, the guy sends you a trail cam, or 6 days later, he sends you a trail cam picture of that same deer, right? Like, oh, I hit it in the butt or whatever it may be, right? And I still struggle with it. You know, we're 300 tracks in. And there's times I'm like, what the hell are you doing, dog? Like, this can't be right. But what I've learned as far as blind trust, I'm willing to go farther on that first line out, right? Like yes. when I set my dog down, that first line, if I'm not 800 yards away from the hit site, I ain't picking them up. Unless we get to a river or a property line or something that I can't just trust them in, I'm going to go a long ways. I don't care if I see blood or I don't see blood or whatever it is. That first pass, I'm going to let him go. And I think a lot of that is when he was 2-3 years old, he got so excited to track, right? Like he wants to go. He gets in the truck and he's so amped up. When I set him down, he's just still amped up. He's, you know, he's a boy. He's a boy on prom night, right? Like, which way do I go? I don't know what I'm doing, but I know I want to do it, right?
Like, right.
And I got to the point where I was actually, like, getting my kids to fire up the four-wheeler and let them chase it for 10 minutes before I put them in the truck just to burn some of that crazy energy off so he would focus when he got. Now, at 6 years old, I don't do that, right? I throw him in the truck.
Right.
Put him in the creek, away we go. He may get excited. He definitely does, right? Like, he gets excited at the beginning of every track, but I think a lot of what you're dealing with is just adolescence in a dog. And the other thing, again, I hate to talk about this, like I understand this stuff, but for me, my dog is so prey driven that finding a dead deer is his number one thing in life. Like he could care less that he's making me happy. Right. Like I'm just a vehicle to get him there so that I can let him go and go find the deer. If he finds the deer, like you can't get your hand in there. Right. Like you're trying to drag it out of the woods and he's pulling it the other direction. I don't see that out of bloodhounds. Right. I see that they're more right. They're more wanting to please you. Right. It's so finding a deer, you get there, you're praising them. Right. And away you go, right? So I could see that being a distraction for them with a live deer. You know what I mean? Like, because the focus isn't when I find the prize, I'm going to get to chew on its butt and drag it around. Right. It's I got to walk and chase a deer, and my owner was proud of me. And, like, so I don't know how to reward a bloodhound, I guess, right? Like, I've always been able to, like, here's the dead deer, and that's the reward. Like, my dog doesn't care whether I pat him on the head or kick him in the butt at that point. Like, just stay away from his deer.
It's funny you say that, because my dog around the deer is the weirdest. It's sometimes embarrassing. It's just the weirdest thing. She doesn't – she might lick it a little bit. She certainly doesn't pull on anything. She might lick the wound. But the minute you touch the deer and make the deer move, it freaks her out. She doesn't want to be near it. And she's just – it's just super weird. She's starting to get over that a little bit. But I think, you know, fingers crossed, I'm hoping you're right, and I'm thinking you're right, Dave, that might be adolescence. I know you and I kind of talked about that before, but – You know, I think there's something to that. And I think as the season went on, I started to understand things better. And I think she started to mature a little bit as we started to, you know, reach that 40 track mark for this past season, you know. But Mitch and Carrie,
Go ahead, buddy. I know you got to play sheriff. I'd be interested to hear other guys with senior bloodhounds, like if they reward their dog differently at a deer. Like you find a dead deer, like I would think that you got to go create like all the reward that you could possibly give that dog at that point, because the deer is not the prize. It's your praise, right? Like, I would think you really want to be like, you're the best dog ever, right? What do I need to give you to make you understand that the dead one is the key
that's the one. Yeah for sure. Mitch and Carrie, what do you think about that, trusting your dog in you know, the scenario that I outlined, my real world? You know, do you have any relatable experiences or words of wisdom?
We've got a dandy from last year. We took a track for a guy down in Texas, and he had a friend with him. And I think he had 2 days left in the season, and he finally was able to arrow a buck. But we get down there, we put board arc on it. She's spot on, you know, most all the way. We get to a spot, in the track. We're in the middle of the woods, and we scare up a bunch of hogs to our right. Well, instantly, Bodark, she flat out stops what she's doing. She's locked on to where the hogs were at, and I'm telling her, get back to work. So she'd start tracking again. Boom, she'd stop again. Look, she did that like three times. And then I told her, you know, the last time I said, get back to work. So she took about, I don't know, maybe five or 10 steps forward. She hooks in right. So we're instantly thinking she's wanting to go after the hogs.
Okay. Yeah.
We weren't going to have that. So we pulled her off of it. And boy, the joyride we went on. This is one time we really, really, really needed to trust our dog and didn't, because we both thought that she was wanting to go in there after the hogs, and we went a complete mile out of the way knowing she was off, and we kept pushing her.
She wasn't tracking no more. She was searching, and
she was searching in circles, zigzags, circles, you name it. Finally, I just said, we got to go back. So we took the mile walk back. We restarted her at last blood, which is probably about 150 yards back from where we saw the hogs. We restarted her. We get up to where the hogs is at. I said, this time if she cuts in right, we're letting her go. Soon as she hit that spot, boom, she's going right. 15 yards in, blood.
There was, yeah, okay, yep.
So, yep. Yeah, she made us look like fools on that one.
Yeah, we could probably spend a whole...
Sometimes
go ahead,
we get to thinking, there's no way this deer went that way. You know, my mind's telling me deer went this way. And I'm wanting the dog to go that way, and she's going a different direction. And I'm like, there's no way that deer went that way. But it usually the deer went that way. Like the one we tracked for this past season in Texas, this deer went straight up. I'm talking straight up an embankment that the dogs couldn't even climb.
Oh, yeah.
But the deer went straight up. We had to jump up and hang on to a tree root that was sticking out of the side of this bank and pull up to climb this embankment straight up.
Bodark actually tried to jump up that, and she ended up falling back on her back. So when she hit the ground, she got up. She went straight back towards the creek, turned around, and just took off on a dead run. Then she got up it. Right when I crawled up top, you know, I had to pull myself up by those roots. But right there, just blood everywhere.
But we were like, there's no way this deer went this way. He was shot, he was center punched in the chest with a broadhead. He had bled buckets, but he went straight up is an understatement. But if we would have trusted, you know, we should have trusted her.
Did you recover the deer?
No. No, we think what happened was
I probably could have told you no, because you said the minute you said frontal with a broadhead, I said I bet you didn't get it.
Well, you should have seen the amount of blood at this thing.
Yeah, brisket shots, man. They do. They bleed like hell.
Hey,
I'm coming to find.
Yep. He got something, because where he hit the deer for about the first 150 yards, it literally looked like somebody just took off running with a bucket, dumping blood.
Spraying.
It was just
but
big puddles of it.
I've had to control myself and let her be the dog. And I've had to control myself. And now Cypress, I'm still leery with her because she's still young.
She's still a pup,
So Bodark, we've learned to trust more, but it's trying to, I don't know what I'm trying to say. I have to fight that urge, because there's an urge to want to go my own way. than what she's telling us. But learning to read her language and how she's been tracking up to that point where you question it makes a big difference on trust, you know, continuing to trust
yep.
her. So learning to read Absolutely. The dog is a big key in my trusting. Right.
Yep.
So
yeah.
I'm tracking behind the dog, I'm focused, like I'm like tunnel visioned on the dog, reading mm-hmm. her body language. And like if he's behind me, he's looking for blood because I'm with the dog, so you know it's going fast. So if I'm behind him, I'm looking for blood for that confirmation. So
yep. Absolutely.
But it's just
it's nice to have a partner. I mean
the body language
reading
the dog, reading the body language has a lot to do with whether I'm trusting her at that point or not, you know.
Yep, absolutely. And that's what that kind of goes back, Carrie, to the point I made. Yes, you must trust your dog, but it's not blind trust. You got to trust, in my opinion, you got to trust your dog based on how you know your dog mm-hmm. and what the dog is telling you in the reads that you've come to understand in your time behind her. Nick, what about you, man? What are your thoughts, comments, or feedback based on my tale of woe?
Yeah, no, I like what you said about the whole blind trust thing, because that is true. You have to know your dog, and you start learning your dog's behaviors and traits as far as tracking goes. Like my dog, he normally works 5 feet on, 5 feet off of the actual blood, if there is blood. He'll go 5 feet off, check himself, go across it, and he just zigzags along the trail the whole time. So I can kind of tell if he's on or off. But that was super tough my first year and even part of my second year, because sometimes if there's like a slight wind, he'll work 5-10 feet off downwind of the actual track.
Sure.
So it's like, what are you doing? It's up there. It's over there 10 feet, you know, there's blood everywhere, but he's 5-10 feet downwind of it with his nose down. So yeah, trusting your dog. I mean, it's not a, like you said, a blind trust. No, but once you start learning your dog's traits, it becomes a different factor. But then also what you said about the cornfield, I think it was the cornfield with the gut pile. Or maybe it was a different track with the gut pile. But anyways, the gut pile, my dog, when he gets close to a dead deer, as far as nose to the ground, that's over. His nose goes up in the air when he gets within 50 yards of a dead deer or a gut pile or anything like that. When he smells it. When he smells a dead deer, whether it's the deer we're tracking or not, it could be a different one. He's on his hind two legs, nose in the air. He'll run 10 feet, put his nose in the air again, run 10 more feet, nose in the air again, all the way to that deer. Like as far as following the actual scent on the ground, it's over once he finds a dead deer. And it might not even be the one we're tracking. So,
yeah. You know, funny story about that air sanding. It sounds like Fletcher, the way you say he works to track, sounds like I think they call it bracketing the scent. He's over, he gets on the left side, then he comes over to the right side. So that nostril tells him to go back left. But nonetheless, you know, you talk about air scenting and that is fun. Dave, I think you brought, or no, Matt Davis brought it up when we were talking about recording. He recommended record your tracks, even if it's nothing more. You don't have to share them, but to go back and, you know, the old football coach in me, break down film. And I've done that on my training tracks. I do that more on my training tracks, and I haven't recorded a lot, only a few of my real tracks. But, you know, when it comes to air scenting, it's very evident, you know, that's an easy read. Sometimes it's subtle, but it's easy read. Our last recovery, our first year of the 2022 season, was a total air scent. And I'll tell you the story real quick, then we'll go on to our next topic. But, you know, we tracked it the night before. We were there too early, couldn't recover it. It was a weird deal. We found a mass of gut material in a bush about 5 feet off the ground, and it was a mess. I'm like, well, we got to come back. So I came back the next day. The hunter wasn't with us, and went back to the shot site, and the wind was a steady wind, probably 10-12 mile an hour. And it was like that the whole night before. Well, we went all the way back on some state land to the shot site. I put her on a, you know, the blood had all, it wasn't visible at this point, but she was acting weird. Her head was up. She kept pushing to the, you know, deeper into the woods, which was downwind of the line. I know where the line was because we were there the night before and I had my Onyx and there was blood, but she just kept, excuse me, she was downwind of that pushing into the woods and she finally, but she just kept gradually working her way towards the open grass field. She broke out into that grass field and boom, her head came up like that. And it was just this, Dave, you said it, I think, bird dogging the whole way. I'm like, well, I don't know. She's not tracking, but she smells something. I'm just going to let her go. And we got right back to the path that we were on the night before. And I looked across this tiny little hedgerow and there laid the damn deer. The night before, I would have walked within 3 feet of where that deer was. It wasn't there the night before because it was still alive. I think it made a big loop. But that wind was blowing the entire – in fact, I did a stream like this, you know, a demonstration of scent drift. I showed this the both track lines and kind of walk through all of that. But that, yeah, you know, you talk about air scenting, that it's a recovery, man. She didn't track it, but she air scented it. And we were 300 yards away and she walked us right to it. It was super cool. But yeah. So yeah, that's the trust your dog and why it was hard for me. I gave you two examples. There were more of, you know, the goose chases, as I call them.
I do have something real quick, Matt. It can be as far as just a yes or no on this. I came across something super, what I would call rare this season on a track, and it kind of goes along with trusting my dog. So I trusted my dog. This was a shoulder shot deer, did not get a pass through. Going into the track, I didn't think we were going to recover it because he only said he got like 6-7 inches of penetration. I'm like, okay, probably not going to find this one. Very minimal blood. Trusted the dog. I mean, there was no blood after 50 yards of where he shot. It was an open clover field. Ran across it. About 600 yards away, we came across a couple beds. And what was in the beds, there was no blood, but it was this white, foamy texture, and I've never seen it before in my life. I don't even know, there was so much of it in these beds, but there was no blood and I had no idea what it was. And then we had the foam like leaving the bed, and 50 yards away we jumped the buck up and alive. And now I talked to an experienced tracker in Michigan on it, and he said it's like if you poke into a lung but don't poke all the way through a lung, it can cause, I forget the word he used, but it was super strange. Never saw it before in my life.
Nick, you bring that up, and Dave's shaking his head, so I want to hear your thoughts on that, Dave, before we move to the next topic. But I'm looking at my phone because I thought I saved the picture. There was, here it is right here. If you get expelled foam from the diaphragm was compromised. If it's pink, you will not only hit the diaphragm but a lung. Pure white like this, and I wish I could show you. Pure white like this, those round bright red drops mean you took the diaphragm and hit the liver. Walking off confirms liver. So I'm gonna share this in our text thread so you guys can see it, because I was really, really taken by that. Nick, what you described, that's kind of what this picture looks like, this white foamy stuff. Cool. You have any thoughts on that, Dave?
I have seen it, right? And same thing. I would be surprised if it actually hit in the shoulder with that kind of foam. I've always heard of it as diaphragm being compromised and minimal problems with the lung, right? Like when I first started tracking, my first couple of years getting out on a track and finding coughed up blood, right? Like a lot of hunters say, oh, there's lung, right? He's coughing up his lung. It's on the ground, right? It's not really lung, right? It's just coagulated blood. It's firm, right? You could grab it. You could stretch it. It's silly putty type stuff, right? But like, I can remember my first year spending an hour like, this deer's got to be dead. Look, there's hunks of stuff, right? And again, mentors, people that have been doing this a long time, right? I was able to talk with people and they're like, just, you know, think logically through it, right? Like if there's something being expelled from the body, from its mouth or its nose, it's got enough force to get it up and out of there, right? Like, so if you've collapsed one lung, you haven't collapsed the other lung, it's got enough force to get that out its mouth and blow, right? Like, now, we've all seen deer with blood rushing out their nose and their mouth is full of blood when we find them dead, right? But that's not at 500 yards, right? Like, you're not finding mouth coughed up blood and in a dead deer at 500. That deer is dead early on, right? So it kind of took me a while to understand, like, oh, when I see coughed up blood or coagulated blood or foam like that, that deer still has some ability to use its lungs for what they're made for, right? To breathe.
Yeah. If it's able to generate some type of pressure.
Right. We wouldn't see that type of sign at 500 yards, right? So now, is it going to die? Right? Like crapshoot, right? But it's not dead for a reason at that point, right? So when you find that bed, if it's at 100 yards, I'm excited, right? If I find that bed at 500 yards, maybe I'm not so excited anymore, right?
Like, right, exactly.
Live that long, what's the difference, right?
Yep.
I've had a ton of them like that, but I've had a ton where hunters call and say, oh, he's coughing up lung, right?
And I have two stuff. I have two, and I just thought this one was weird because, I mean, as far as the track went, there was less blood than what you probably would find on a teaspoon throughout the whole track. But when we got to the bed, like 600 yards away, I mean, there were just a couple drops where he shot. That was it. And other than that, 600 yards away, it was just pure white foam in those beds. It was super strange.
It probably high, what? Right? High into the diaphragm, high into the lung, not getting any exit hole and not blowing any blood out. Not that that can't kill a deer. It's just not going to put a lot of sign on the ground.
Not near term dead. That's 2-3 days dead, maybe.
Sorry, I didn't mean to derail that there for you, Matt. But.
No, you didn't derail anything, man. It's a conversation. It's because why it's called a Trackers Forum. I just text the group that picture that I was just reading from. So as you can take a look at it. So this should be a fun conversation. You know, what got you into tracking? And I'll just start with me, and I'll be really brief because I'm interested in your guys's. But you know, I was always been intrigued by working dogs back in 30 years ago or whatever. I had bird dogs, was a terrible bird hunter and was never a good dog trainer, but I had bird dogs and I liked working dogs. And then I went for a long period of time with nothing. And then, you know, my son-in-law got a German Shepherd and my daughter son-in-law got a German Shepherd and took some interest in tracking deer, which I always thought I was intrigued by, but never put a lot of thought into it. And we started training. Demi is her name, which is, you know, my logo is an homage to Demi, who got me into tracking, you know, because I have a shepherd on here. But, so we did it 1 year, and I got bit bad by that bug watching that German Shepherd work her magic and track that deer, you know, on our practice tracks. I didn't know squat, still don't, but knew even less then. And we went on 5 or 6 tracks with Demi that first year, and our very first track we went on, we recovered the deer, and then nothing after that. Well, I didn't realize, you know, I didn't know what I didn't know at the time. And reflecting back now, after having a couple of seasons and a lot more videos and a lot more mentorship under my belt, I realized the deer that we were tracking, those, you know, that small handful, they just simply weren't dead deer at the time. You know, when I didn't know that, I thought the dog was losing her mind. We'd go on a track and she would track it for a while, and all of a sudden she'd grab a stick and start playing. And I'm like, oh no, this is so embarrassing. What is she doing? Well, it's because she's telling me your damn deer's not dead, Dad. Let's go play fetch. You know, so we didn't track much after that. But the following year, you know, so that bit me. That got me. You know, that was my bug. And then of course now I'm watching every video. I'm watching you know. Every video I can about tracking, and you know, Ron Slifer, I'm watching, Brian Alberta and his dog Bindy's, his bloodhound. I'm watching, Gary and Diesel, you know, I'm watching everybody. So I started, you know what, man, I want to get a dog, and this is what I want to do. And my wife told me, my wife hates dogs, and now I'm getting into how I selected this breed, but I'll save that for when we get there. But, you know, I was to the point where I was ready to retire from coaching football after 27 seasons. You know, my kids have all grown now, and my wife says, you have got to find something to do in the fall. I'm like, you know what, you're right, I want to track deer. And it was game on from there. It was really game on when we started training Demi. But, you know, now it's really kind of it's a compulsive disorder for me, as it probably is all of you guys too, because if I'm not thinking about tracking or work or right now my golf cart project, I'm sleeping, you know. But that it really consumes me. It's just how my brain works. So that's why and how I got into tracking. And you know, I'm hoping it's a huge part of my life. I hope it's as big a part of my life for the next however many years I can do it, as football was for 27 for me. And football was a very, very big part of my life. So that's how I got into it. What about you, Nick?
So what originally, I love the outdoors. I've loved hunting whitetail deer since I started hunting when I was like 10 years old. When I was in high school, my dad actually wounded a deer, and he called a deer tracking dog to come in, and it was a mountain cur. And I was like, okay, a mountain cur, I never heard of that breed before, you know? And the guy actually recovered my dad's deer within minutes. It was a gut shot. And I was hooked. So when I got a little bit older, I got a mountain cur, and I started tracking with them, training them to track and all that. Well, then I had kids and got married, and life got busy, so I got out of it. My kids are a little bit older now. They're not very old, but they're in school now and all that. So life's kind of slowed down, not in the baby phase anymore. I was like, you know what? I'm going to get back into it. And my family, everyone I knew, they thought I was crazy. Like, you ain't going to know how to train a dog. Like, what are you doing going to track these deer? I didn't have much support behind me at the time. Like, you know, I don't care, I'm going to prove them all wrong. Well, I'm 3 years in now, and guess who's calling for advice on when they make a bad shot, as far as deer goes, or deer tracking goes. So, yeah, that's kind of how I got into it. I'm not sure where Matt just went.
We lost the sheriff.
I know. I think you're muted there, Dave.
Sorry, yeah, I was talking.
I seen you talking, but I couldn't hear you.
I said, I bet he was going to make that Pyrenees be quiet. It couldn't be the bloodhound making the noise in the background.
Yeah, but no, I mean, I didn't have much support when I got into it, but I fell in love with it, and... You're back.
I'm back. Yeah, sorry, guys. I was about ready to strangle the dog. No, it wasn't my bloodhound. It was my damn Pyrenees. and my wife's
little... It was a good guess on my part.
Yeah. My wife's little yapper. Back to where you, little runt. Yep, sorry, guys. So...
We carried on.
Oh, yeah.
What's that?
Well, so we carried on.
I knew you would. Mitch and Carrie, what got you guys into it?
Pass the baton to Mitch and Gary, I think.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, we got tired of losing animals, mainly hogs. Because when we would shoot hogs are hard to bring down. But we just got tired of losing animals. And, you know, we would search days at a time because we don't like to lose an animal.
Yeah.
And we...
We actually considered... getting a tracking dog. I think it was like 2017. And we came across a couple of Kimmer curs. So we got them as pups. And even though, you know, we'd lay a short bloodline down for them, but they just didn't seem real interested in
it. We couldn't connect with them. But we didn't know what we were doing either.
We ended up giving them to a friend of ours. And from that point on, we just kind of shrugged it off for a couple years. Well, a few years. And then here 3 years ago, we got to talking about it again, and
because
we thought, well, let's do it. Let's stop talking about it and do it.
Because we didn't have nobody we could call either. There was nobody here.
There was nobody here.
So we started searching.
We did our research. We definitely did that, and that's kind of how we came up with the breed we've got now.
So we're
I got a real quick question for you guys. Do you guys use the same dog, track hogs and whitetail, like all multiple different big game?
Yeah.
Okay. That's cool.
Yeah, and actually we were able to put Bodark, and we've got to tell you this on the last podcast we did. Talking about all the dangerous stuff we have to do here.
Yeah.
We forgot to mention the bears and the alligators.
Yeah.
So we got to deal with
alligators in Oklahoma?
Yeah.
Yes.
Are you sure you're not tracking in the freaking zoo?
Yeah, we got gators.
We've got a spot. We've done several tracks in from last year and this year, and it does have quite a few gators in it, and it's very swampy stuff. So
we tracked out into a swamp. We were hoping that the gators were hibernating because we were knee deep in that swamp tracking for a guy. And there's
you ever come across the gator while tracking?
Not yet. Cross fingers.
But the long story short, we got tired of losing animals because we're hunters, and it's we gave it everything we had to find when we would lose something. We needed that extra help. So we caught ourselves. He actually started it really, but we started watching YouTube videos and reading books and taught ourselves how to teach a dog.
How to train a dog.
Yeah, train a dog. So just the loss of animals.
That's how I did it, man. You know, I'm YouTube trained, and you know, I tell you, there's a lot of good stuff out there. You have got to know how to filter, though. There is a lot of garbage out there too.
Right.
So
attending the events has really helped us too. Tracklahoma and the Missouri Symposium that we went to last year. Those events.
You guys
really
went to fun. You went to that?
Yeah.
Matt was at the Missouri Symposium last year when we were there.
That's where we got Bodark's UBT2 certification in Missouri at Merrimack Park.
There's a couple people from the Michigan Deer Tracking Network that went to that too. And I'm going to have to look at that because I hear it's a really, really good one. So what I need it to be late in the year so I can ride my Harley down there. You know, I don't know if I probably wouldn't take my dog because I'm not going to test. But go ahead, Mitch.
I got to tell you something about that real quick. You're talking about riding your Harley down there.
Yeah.
If you want to ride a Harley anywhere, ride it down here because we have next to nothing for wind. I mean, it's like that all the time.
You know, how being wise or. You really don't have a lot of wind.
How windy it is up north, all the time. It's not like that here at all.
Until you're hunting in southern Oklahoma, yeah,
right.
Until you're hunting, then you got wind like this.
Well, it does that, but there's really no wind behind anything.
Yeah,
you might get
five
or 10 mile an hour gusts.
But that's
it. Most of the time, it's calm.
Yeah, well, sounds like I need to make a trip to Oklahoma. My mom actually, shortly before she died, the guy she married, she moved to Oklahoma and was there for a little over a year or so before she came back home to Michigan. And so I spent a little bit of time down there. Yeah, it was cool. Yep. Dave, what about you, buddy? What got you into it, man?
I think we touched on this maybe a little bit in one of the stories we told last time, but actually I picked up John's book randomly because I don't know how to point.
Yeah, there you go. I know what you're Weimy.
Yeah. So my Weimaraner, right. I had a Weimaraner for 13 years, bird dog, right. That he was just me and him, right. It was the longest relationship I ever had in my life. I think, you know, We were inseparable for, you know, 13 years basically, but he got, he'd had a incident with a milk truck when he was really young and broke a leg, and he got over it pretty quickly. But as he got older, it calcified, right? And he couldn't run birds and stuff anymore. And I used to run him every day, like let him out of the car and let him run 2 miles up a dirt road and 2 miles back down. And then let's go to, he'd go to work with me every day. And it really didn't tire him out. And then I just noticed like him being in the woods and him huffing and smelling, right? It really come home, he'd be wiped out from just walking in the woods for half an hour compared to running up and down the hill. So long story short, when his leg got bad enough and he couldn't run anymore, I was like, man, I should do something with his nose. And that's how I stumbled on John's book, really. I didn't know anything about deer tracking. I was a huge bow hunter in my mind, right? Like shot every spike horn I could find, I shot it. Like I thought I was this big bow hunter, right? But I loved doing it, right? And then somehow I stumbled on John's book and it never did anything with it, right? I read it and then Gus was my Weimaraner. He was just too old at that point, right? Didn't do anything with it and kind of just put him away. And then he passed and didn't have a dog, right? Had family, got a couple kids, and just we weren't ready to have a dog and two little kids. And then I made a bad shot. Everything you tell a hunter not to do, I did it on a deer that surprised me, you know, quartering hard to me, shot him, quartering hard to me, and gut shot him. And watched him run out maybe 300 yards and stand in a wide open field, and you could see his gut hanging out of him, right? Like it's a dead deer, but you know, I knew enough at the time to just leave him alone. And he stood in one spot for a half an hour. Like it was amazing. Like he never moved more than 5 or 6 feet for a half an hour. Wow. I went back out there 6 hours later and couldn't find a speck of blood. Right? Like it was crazy to me, but this point I didn't know anything about tracking or anything, and went and was talking to my buddy and had a couple beers, and about the third beer, that's usually when my intelligence kicks in for anything that I do. I was like, hey, I read this book about this guy that has dogs, right? And I called my wife and I said, in my office there's this book with this little crappy dog on the front of it and a dead deer, right? Like there's some company in there that finds deer, right? Like look through it. And she's like, hangs up, calls me back, and she's like, it's called Deer Search, right? It says Deer Search on it, and there's an 800 number, and this is the guy's name. And she goes, at the very back of this book, it says he's from Bern, New York. And I'm like, shut up, right?
You got the book right?
Literally find out that John Genene lives 7 miles from my house and never knew anything about tracking. And I pick up the phone, I called him. I called Deer Search. He actually was the guy. So Deer Search is like the original tracking, right? Like Gene Genene wrote the book on it. He also wrote the legislation in New York State and got temporary permits to go do this. And Deer Search was an 800 number that they set up and somebody manned the phones. They still do it to this day. Unfortunately, like, you know, technology's gone past that. So we're trying to figure out how to keep Deer Search alive, other than answering the phone. But that's where we're at with Deer Search. But John answered the phone at his house and said, I said, hey, I'm looking for somebody to help me track a deer. And I'll never forget it. He's like, what did you do and how bad did you fuck it up? I'm sorry. He said, why are you calling so late? What did you do to fuck it up? And I said, well, I didn't have your number until just a couple minutes ago. And I called you immediately as soon as I could. And when I told him I hadn't like stomped all over the track, like things I don't know, I didn't know then. Right. Like he's asking me like, did you and 10 of your buddies go look for this deer? And when I told him all that, he's like, well, this is a dead deer. He goes, but I'm old enough now that I don't track anymore. He's like, but we just sold a puppy to a guy that lives not far from your town. Right. And when I say I grew up in a small town, I mean like kindergarten through 12th grade, 400 or 500 people, like graduating 35 kids in a class, small, right? I'm like, there's no way there's somebody that lives within 20 miles of me that has a dog that tracks deer that I don't know about. Sure as shit, he shows up the next day and I never met the guy a day in my life. And he's just a couple years younger than me. And he steps out of the truck with Winnie, just over a year old, wired haired dachshund. And the guy that Jared, the tracker, is 6'3", 240 pounds. And I'm like, what? the fuck are you going to do? Sorry, but that's what I said to him. I go, what are you going to do with that dog? And he flat out said to me, he goes, you're my first real track ever. He goes, but we've been training. He goes, we'll have to see what she does. And long, yep. 900 yards later, we're standing at a deer that coyotes had destroyed. And, you know, it took us a bit to get there. But that was on November 5th. And on December 5th, I was in Alabama picking my dog up and driving him back because it was just
the coolest goddamn
thing I had ever seen in my life. Like, yeah. I was just so hooked, right? Like, I couldn't. And I didn't think anything would ever take bow hunting away from me. Tracking is done at this point. Like, I still bow hunt when I can, but it's taken the, oh, I need to go check every trail camera that I have in the woods every day away from me, right? Like, it's all focused on tracking at this point. So
that's funny you mentioned that, Dave, because the evolution of my hunting career is I don't want to say I'm on a downhill slide, but I'm seeing myself in how my grandpa was when I started hunting, in where, you know, I guess I'm off topic now, but I guess I get to do this. But, you know, where he took more joy in watching me and my uncle come up and tell the stories or come show him our deer than he did than sitting in the stand. Now, he liked to go out and hunt and stuff. And I'm kind of that way now. You know, I like to bow hunt and I go out, but nothing like I used to. And, you know, I really enjoy listening. You know, my son-in-law, he's, you know, he's a city boy. Didn't know how to spell hunting, you know, until he married my daughter and, you know, on our farm here. And now he's a fanatic, much like I was, only about times two. And, you know, and I really get a kick out of, you know, him putting in the work and telling his stories and all of that. I still like to hunt, but I'd rather track. Except for that first week of gun season. Then in Michigan, like probably most places, it's a national holiday. And, you know, I grew up gun hunting. So it's a massive family time. It's a big tradition. So anyway, sorry, Dave. I hijacked your
segment. No, I was done.
I got off topic.
Here in Oklahoma, our schools close for deer season.
Really? Some schools do up north.
Yeah.
When I say up north, in northern Michigan, but in my little village of Springport, you know, they probably could too because we're a farming community and same thing. So, yeah. Hey, man, hunting's a big deal everywhere. So, well, cool. So we talked about why we got into tracking. And we got sort of touched on some of it tied into why we chose a particular breed we chose. And Dave, your story kind of dovetailed both of those together, you know, but obviously you can hear more about it if you want to talk more about it. But, you know, I'll just say I chose Bloodhound because some of it was naivety. But probably for a year, year and a half before I got a Bloodhound, I was following, you know, the Bloodhound pages on Facebook because I became super duper intrigued by him. By, like I said, the Ron Slifer and Dio and you know, Brian Alberta and Bindi. And there are others. I'm like, man, I just love the Bloodhound, you know. And then I just kind of like goofy, lovey dogs anyway. And everything I was reading is they're just big, big family lover dogs. And the funny thing is, Bloodhounds represent every single thing my wife hates in a dog. They stink, they slobber, they shed, they bark obnoxiously, and she let me freaking get one. So I'm like, holy hell, I can't, yeah. But I say the naivety part, I knew what I was in for because I'd done the research. And, you know, a Bloodhound, for anybody listening that's considering, you know, what kind of dog to get, and you hear Bloodhound, oh, yeah, oh, Duke, Jed Clampett's dog just lays on the porch. Wrong song, ding dong. I like to describe Bloodhounds, particularly young ones, as a caffeined toddler. You know, they are, you know... they are not that lazy dog. They're pretty smart, pretty obnoxious, but I love it. I love every bit of it. And, you know, the naivety part was, you know, I did a lot of research on, you know, whose dog got the most powerful nose. Well, by God, it's a bloodhound. A bloodhound, by the way, is the only dog whose findings are admissible in the court of law. Only animal whose findings are admissible in the court of law. That's how revered and renowned the bloodhound's scent ability is. So I'm thinking, well, shit, I want every ounce of sniffing power I can get. You know, and oh, and by the way, I want a big goofy lovey dog, so stinky, shedding, slobbering goober. And so that's kind of how I settled on bloodhound. You know, I've already been thinking about what would my next dog be. You know, I figure, you know, bloodhounds have short lives. You know, their tracking career is probably 9 years maybe, you know, and then you're slowing down pretty good, I'm figuring. You know, so in the twilight of her career, you know, I want to get a puppy, so I'm never without a dog. I can train it. So when she's retired, I've got something, you know, so two bloodhounds, holy crap. You know, I don't know about that, but I'll probably do it, but I'll probably stick with bloodhound. But that's kind of why I came up with a bloodhound. You know, not now from a powerful nose perspective. Yes, they have an incredibly powerful nose, and I love that. But that doesn't make them any more superior to finding deer than a lab or a Catahoula or a foxhound or a mountain hound or a wired-haired teckel, you know, any of those things. I think to some degree there might be a diminishing return in the tracking dog sense from nose power, you know, because most all of those dogs are more than adequate. You know, you talk about Jenna's book in talking about the bloodhound. He said one of the things about the bloodhound to consider is, and you guys, if you've read the book, you might remember this, is that their noses are so powerful that they can track, and you mentioned this a minute ago, Nick, how Fletcher was tracked, you know, 5 yards downwind of the line. In you know, he said bloodhounds' nose are so powerful that they can track down it perfectly fine, but you are missing sign because they're off the line. But they're on the track, but they, you know, how do I say it? They're on the line but off the track, or on the track but off the line. Whatever the right.
You're off the track, but they're on it.
Yeah. You know, but you know, so but I'll probably stick with bloodhound. That'll probably be my next one. So. Nick, what got you to foxhound?
So originally I started when I got into tracking, watched a mountain cur. So I went out and got a mountain cur. And my mountain cur was a rescue pup. When I got back into it, I'm like, I started doing some research and Googling and all that and the whole nine yards and foxhound. So I wasn't set on foxhound. I had a different list of breeds that I was just looking for. And if the right dog came up, that was the dog I was going to get. And I'll do this plug real quick, and I'm not saying go on there and get a dog from this site, but I rescued my mountain cur from rescueme.org, and I was just on there one day, and I was like, you know what, I'm going to get on rescueme.org. I haven't been on there in 6 years, and sure as can be, there was a foxhound available for adoption in Michigan. And I was like, you know what, I'm going to message this lady, and she had a fee or whatever. And it was all the way up in Cadillac, like a 3-hour drive. And I texted my wife. I never even met the dog. I just took a leap of faith. I was like, hey, would you go up there and pick up this dog? He's 8 months old. It's a foxhound. I want to get into track. And she's like, okay. So she drove up there, picked this dog up, not realizing how big this dog was. And I got home from work that day, and I got him. And he's wound up, super hyper. So I rescued him off that same site. And it was kind of a cool story. I mean, it was a super sad story of how I got him. So a fisherman found a litter of 8 foxhounds thrown in a duffel bag in a river.
Oh, geez. I don't go in much detail. I don't want to feel bad.
I know I won't, but that's how. And then, but Fletcher was the last one to get adopted.
Okay.
So they all got adopted to loving, happy homes, and Fletcher was the last one to get adopted. And Now he's tracking deer and loves life. He was a little scared of water for a little bit, but he's past it now. If he smells a deer on the other side of a river, bet your ass he's dragging you through the river to get to it. Yeah. So he's all about it now. But that's kind of how I got a foxhound, and it was just a luck of the draw. Like I said, there was like 8 to 10 different breeds I was looking at: bloodhounds, foxhounds, Catahoula, mountain cur, black mouth cur. I was kind of open to anything, and Fletcher just kind of fell in my lap.
But you have a pup now, and it's a plot something mix.
I do have a pup. He's a plot walker, and the reason I got him, it was a guy from work. He's done generations and generations of breeding dogs for bear hunting. So, and he had a litter of pups come up, and I wasn't really ready, but at the same time, I've always loved the brindle pattern on dogs. And he was kind of a cooler looking brindle. He's lighter in color. And I was like, he gave me a deal on it because I knew him from work and all that. But so I was like, you know what? We'll give it a shot. Fletcher's going to be he'll be 5 this year, his 4th year in tracking. So I figure if I get him started now, by the time he's 2-3 years in, Fletcher's going to be 7-8 years old. He's going to be winding down, getting a little slower, and I'll have a new dog going into his prime.
That's great, great succession planning. I don't think I'm going to be fortunate enough to be able to do it with that much life left in my bloodhound with my lovely bride. But
my wife wants to kill me.
Okay.
Yeah, she's not happy. She is not thrilled I got another puppy, especially another hound in the house running around.
What? They're just lazy hounds.
Around
and skink, right? Yeah, that's what the hounds do.
Knocking over a 4-year-old howling through the house at night. It's not good.
Mitch and Carrie, how'd you land on Bavarians?
Good.
We knew that we wanted a smaller compact dog, but we wasn't sure what we really wanted. We were just watching YouTube one day, and all of a sudden this video pops up of this guy over in like Austria Ireland, somewhere over there. Poland,
I think.
And he had this little puppy, and I still remember his name was Angus. And he was training this little puppy to track. And I don't know, but me and him both looked at each other, and like these light bulbs popped on. And I started Googling what it was, the Bavarian. And we just both knew at the same time. I don't know what it was, but
you know, we like the red, the dark red that fades into black face.
Yeah. Yeah,
and black tail, and we like the fact that they weren't too big and they weren't too small. They're, you know, kind of in between. In that
they 40 were baby pounds. Bears, just right, huh?
Mm-hmm. Right. So we did our research on them. Boom, right there. We decided that's what we wanted.
Yeah. It took us a while to find a reputable breeder. And thank God we hooked up with Cynthia, because that's where we got Bodart. We got her from North Carolina, and we drove to North Carolina and got her because we were on like a 2-year waiting list, and then we had to fill out like this questionnaire like we were buying a house.
You see, Cynthia's extremely picky about people who buy puppies from her. She's not doing it now because her husband passed away, but you literally have to fill out an application.
Yeah.
But just like buying a house.
But these dogs carry a lot of diseases with the wrong bloodlines. So, you know, we researched that we're very into the integrity of the breed. So I don't want to get something, they get Addison's and things like that. But, yeah. Being behind Bodark and Cypress tracking is tough enough. Like I said, y'all that track with these big dogs, my hat's off to you, because they pull my arm off with just them. You know, especially if they hit a live one.
If they hit a a hot track, boy. It, they dig in.
Game on, yeah.
I'm not sure. Maybe this is something like you wouldn't even want to do to your dog or whatever, but a more experienced tracker taught me this because I have a bigger dog is if you have a lead on them, you half inch right above their hind, right in front of their hind legs, it slows my dog down dramatically.
We've done
that. I even do it with my little dog sometimes, just to slow him down.
It works.
Yeah, just to slow whenever him down. We have hit, they hate it.
Yeah, they don't like
it. They start flopping around on the ground like a fish.
you go track a lady. I'm tangled up in this mess you put me in. I'm not doing that
because they want to go, and then we have hitch because we can't keep up with two legs. So but we kind of got weird. We're stuck on Bavarian. We're like,
yeah.
Even though their attitudes and temperaments are different.
And they will kill chickens and cats and turkeys and ducks. And
they are always into something.
Prey drive.
Yeah, prey drive.
And they dig holes. They will dig plumb down to China.
Oh, that would drive me up a stinking wall.
They are
my
diggers.
My bloodhound does a little bit, not bad. My wife's little cavipoo digs more than my Pyrenees and my bloodhound does, a little runt.
And they're bad chewers. Well, Cypress is really a bad chewer.
Bodark doesn't chew.
Cypress,
yes.
She chewed the rim on my new car. The rim.
Oh yeah. Okay.
But we love the Bavarians though. We're
working dogs. You get they got to be working. Yeah, and I never heard of Bavarian until I started researching and boy are they very popular and rightfully so. They're very, very capable dogs. And just like what you said, I think my guess is probably a big part of the popularity is they are kind of just right. If you don't want a big 80, 90, 120 pound bloodhound and you don't want a, 20 pound sausage dog, I say that with love, Dave. That Bavarian is kind of right in there. Foxhounds aren't terribly big either, but that Bavarian's, I mean, that's just a really, I've always thought that it's kind of a nice little sporty dog, you know. They have all the athleticism you need, you know, but big enough to get across the, you know, creek. So yeah, they're and they're incredibly capable of finding game. So that's
they
really
want to work.
Yeah,
they love to work.
I bet they do. Yeah. Well, Dave, what about this? You kind of walked us through how you ended up with Winston. You got bit by the bug when your 6'4" friend, that was your first exposure. So anything else to add to that or color you want to add?
Not really. I think that, boy, it might be the toughest thing I ever did was buying a 25-pound dog, right? A dog that I knew was only going to get to 27 pounds, right? Like that's not my MO as a person, right?
Oh. I'm
a big dog, right? Like big truck, gun. That's having a little dog
and your purse
really
dog.
In my forecast. Right. That wasn't in my
forecast. Yeah, you get out of your big four-wheel drive with a studded fender flare, smoking diesel with your dog in your fanny pack. Dave, is that what you do?
You got it. So that's really hard for me to commit to that. See, the biggest thing for me, like if I know what I know now about training a dog, not that I know a whole lot, but knowing what I know now about training a dog, I probably wouldn't have chose that breed, right? Like my ego would have forced me somewhere else. And a Bavarian, I got a buddy that tracks with a Bavarian. Like he's really big into the Bavarian group. Like he flew his dog over. Like I'm like, man, I could see that being the dog that it's right in that middle range. Life expectancy is pretty good. If I'd have known what I know now, that probably would have been my first pick, right? But it's going to be hard for me to go away from a Teckel at this point. Is just about the story that I told before about Jen and A's being in my backyard, him tracking with a Teckel, right? The guy that got me into this, Jared, his dog name was Winnie. That's why Winston is Winston, right? So it would be hard for me to go away from a Teckel at this point as far as tracking goes. And I kind of talk myself into being okay with having a little dog because I say, man, he's going to track, he might track till 12, right? Like you guys that got to train another dog at 7 or 8, I might wait till 10. I hope that I never have to rely on a 1 or a 2 year old tracking dog again in my career. Like,
yeah,
the best 2 year old is a 2 year old in my opinion. Yeah. Right. Again, I've only ever trained one dog. Maybe the next one is just a rock star and he's something different than what I've seen. But I hope to never rely on a 2 year old tracking dog again.
So I'll tell you right now, we're, as far as I go, I'm jealous of you guys. Now we're into my first track of the day and I haven't came up with nothing yet. And Fletcher's dragging me through the woods because there's multiple times where I have face planted holding onto that lead, going down a cliff or up a hill, get briars.
You say that, Nick.
I will say a 27-pound dog is not going to drag you around, right? Like my dog does not drag me around, but I'll tell you what, that dog gets in holes that we're not fitting in, right?
Like, I didn't even think about that.
I am on my hands and knees a lot. Like, how the hell are we in here? And part of trusting your dog, you're like, there's no way a deer comes through here, right? And I'm on my hands and knees, and like, oh, there's blood, right? Like,
that's a valid point. I didn't think about that. We have
no problems. And I find myself carrying a little pain in the ass a lot of times too, right? Like, like, oh, we're going to do a restart and I've got 3 tracks today. I'm like, all right, I'll save your little legs. And I pick them up and I'm carrying them back to do a restart. So,
but that ain't worsening either, Dave, because now you're not getting tangled up. If Winston's like my bloodhound and we're going back to do a restart, she's going to go around the tree the way she wants to go around a tree. She's going to go around the bush the way she wants to go around a bush. And here, you know, so yeah. Sometimes
on the
way
back to the truck, I'm almost always carrying all the way back to the truck. We can be a mile from the truck, and I'm carrying it because I'm like, I'm not dealing with you going underneath this and around that and tied up in a bush. And then,
and I consider that a benefit. No, you talk about being a little bit embarrassed to having a hairy sausage dog. I got to tell you, man, I've watched enough videos with those little suckers. They are not ferocious, but just tenacious, driven little machines. Holy crap.
And that's really why I got them. Like when I saw that 9-month-old or year old dog, whatever Winnie was at the time, right around a year old. And I saw and Jared told me this was her first real track. And she walked us to this deer that we would have never have found with grid searching. It was just too big of a piece of property. We'd have never have found it because I swore the deer went down in the swamp, right? I'm like, there ain't no way it went through this wide open field, all this. I would have never have looked where that deer went. And I'm like, I know nothing about tracking, but I know I want to track, right? Like I'm hooked at this point and I want to do it and I have no idea how to do it. That's the best starting point that I know of, right? Like if something at 9 months old can do that, like I can't mess it up too awful bad. And that was really my thought process, right? It was like, get me something that can help me and I don't mess up. And
that's where I was with bloodhounds. They got the best nose in the world. I thought I was going to find Bigfoot with how, you know, with how good the bloodhound nose is. That just tells you how, you know, go back to the naivety. But it's funny, you know, we all talk about, why we chose the dogs, and a lot of it comes down to imprinting. Dave, you got Winston because the imprinting. You know, we talk about imprinting as puppy training, which, by the way, is the next topic. You know, bloodhounds imprinted on me. I would have a hard time, although I will seriously consider whether my next dog is a bloodhound or something different. But if it's something different, I would seriously be considering a Teckel. I mean, I have nothing but admiration for them. But the problem I got is I'm so ingrained with the tracking styles of a bloodhound that to me is what tracking is. You know, she's in 4-wheel drive mode a lot and she's pulling, but I'm accustomed to her style and the way those Teckels, the way they work, it's just, I'm not used to that, you know.
I might go to a Bavarian with my next dog, but if I go to a Bavarian, it's because I want to challenge myself to start over, right? Like, because I've seen 6 or 7 different Teckels work, and they all work very much like my dog, right?
Sure.
And at this point, I can read my dog, right? So for me to go to a Bavarian, which is just as capable, is me starting not over,
exactly.
You know, more challenge to be able to read another dog, right? And maybe when I'm ready for another dog, I'm ready for a challenge. But if I'm just looking to put deer on the tailgate, I'll probably go back with the same one because I can read him, right?
Tackle was going to be my next choice. It was a tackle. I had actually considered going ahead and getting a tackle, but I've turned into kind of a breed snob, and I can work a Bavarian. I know how to work a Bavarian. Yep. So
like, sure. Like so they're imprinted exactly. You know,
yes, like Dave said, I'm used to that style.
And the cool thing is, there were five dog breeds when we had the full crew together. Every damn one of them is every bit as capable as the other in tracking and finding deer. And that's what's so fun about it. That's what I love about the diversity. I don't consider myself a breed snob at all. And I know, you know, I understand the context with which you said it, Carrie. I just get fascinated with it all. You know, I think Bavarians are awesome. Is it right for me? I don't know. I think Teckels are awesome. You know, just like I think Blue Harleys are beautiful, but it's not for me.
I'll jump in real quick too, that I think a lot of it has to do with the specific dog and not necessarily the breed. Yeah, the breed has a lot to do with it, working dogs, non-working dogs, all that. Sure. But you can have a working dog breed and get not necessarily a dud, but a dog that doesn't have the drive that another pup out of the same litter might have. So I just wanted to throw that in there.
Right. And that's why I wish Jeremiah could have been on with us. I really wanted to hear about his Norwegian elk hound. He tracks deer with a Norwegian elk hound. You know, I really wanted to hear more about that, but that's okay.
I thought it was an Irish wolfhound.
I might have said Irish wolfhound. I meant Norwegian elk hound.
Oh, okay.
It's an elk hound. It's a Norwegian elk hound.
It's big, regardless.
It's a big sucker.
It's a big old fluffy duff, that's for sure. Fluffy so, duff. Okay, guys. We started out, we had 9 topics, so it's going exactly how we all anticipated. We've knocked out 3 of them, and, you know, we've got about 30 minutes left because I would like to keep this within 2 hours so I can upload it. So let's jazz through, and maybe we'll drop off one of these super controversial ones that starts with a D and has R-O-N-E-S in it. You know, we'll see if we – if we cover any ground on that one or not, but let's talk about let's talk about, you know, dog development and defining moments. As you've developed, as we have all evolved and developed to where we're at in our tracking careers, with Dave being the most senior and me being the most junior, and Mitch and Carrie and Nick right smack dab in the middle of that, you know, we've all certainly have noticed, you know, defining moments or noticed progress and development. So if you reflect back on your tracking careers to where you are now, you know, and with the dog you're tracking with now, do you have, what's your story of a defining moment in the development? Do you have a defining moment or two or three that said, hey man, you know, at year 2, I really noticed this change. Is there anything like that that you guys like to share? I'll start with Nick.
Yeah. I don't know if this is much about the dog. I mean, the dog is obviously learning, but I feel like as the handler, I'm learning just as much, if not more, about reading my dog than the dog tracking himself. So, I mean, the defining moments are like where it's like me, like, okay, he just did that again. Okay. Yep. This is how, why is he? Okay. He's working downwind of the blood trail again. Or okay. Yeah. When he throws his nose up in this direction or he circles to the right and he'd be like, when he checks himself, he'll do a right half circle back to the blood trail. Like it's for me, it was more of fun, like reading my dog and then be like, okay, and now I'm picking up on it. Now I'm picking up on it. And then I start to trust him a little more, let him work a little farther. And then the defining moments, obviously the obvious ones are like when he gets his first recovery with like a first true recovery, you know, 600 yards away with no blood, the last 300 yards of the track, or where we'll jump a deer up. You know, those are like the defining moments where you start to really trust your dog. Like, okay, he's doing his job. He's doing what I actually trained him to do. So, but yeah, I mean, it's more for me, it was more just myself learning and picking up on all his cues and to trust him more when I see those cues, to let him go further and let him work farther and then find a speck of blood, you know, another 100 yards away from the last speck. And it's like, okay, he's doing his job. He's got it going. So that's kind of what I got for that. I don't have like any like huge defining moments other than when you find that speck of blood 100, 200 yards away from last blood.
Yeah, and that's just all of those little moments, man, add up to big things. It's just that continuous improvement, that continuous development, man. And I just love that. I just love that stuff. What about you, Dave?
You know, I think for me, it's a lot like Nick said, right? Like the dog's always been able to find a deer if it was a dead deer.
Yeah.
Did we leave dead deer in the woods? Sure. Over the years we have, but I think for me, it's that grind of not finding deer, right? Like if more than half of them aren't dead when you're out there, like I was making excuses every time, right? Like, why didn't we find a dead deer? Why didn't we find a dead deer? Why didn't we find a dead deer? But then you get, for me, the defining moment was when we got on a streak, right? Like the first couple years, I probably only did like Matt, you've got way more experience in 2 years than I did in 2 years, right? Like my first year I was 2 for 13 and one of those deer was dead within eyesight. Right. You know what I mean? Like I didn't know what I was doing, but I would just, and it really wasn't that popular here, even though it's odd to say that John had been around, it just wasn't a thing that hunters knew about. Right. And then by my second year, I got like 30 or 35 calls or something. And we found 7, 8 deer our second year, but they were like, find one, didn't find one for 4 or 5 tracks, then found 1, 5, 6 tracks. Year 3, we start off, I think we went 7 for 7, right? Like out of the rip, October 1st to October 5th, we got 7 deer on the tailgate. And I'm like, eureka, like somebody turned the on switch on, right? Like we now know what we're doing, right? And then we go 2 for our next 11, right? But that streak like really was the defining moment for me. Like when we were in the middle of 7 for 7, I was like, oh yeah, like this dog can do it and I can do it, right? It was like this eureka moment for me of we can do this, right? And you know, as we're 6 years into this now, the streaks come and go, you know, this year, you know, I think we near the end of the year after Winston got sick, I started filtering calls a little bit more because I just couldn't run them into the ground near the end. Right. And we go 5 for 6 to end the season and it made our season. Right. Like, you know, I always want to say like, oh, I'd love to get 30 recoveries in a year or 35, but I can't do that, right? And I haven't taught Winston how to shoot for people yet, so it's like
of course
we're at the mercy of the hunter always with that stuff, and we so much hang our good season on recoveries, right? And we have really no control over it other than did we leave a dead one in the woods or didn't we, right? And as far as I know,
tracks are deer that don't end up on the tailgate, so you know, there's a reason. If I could just interject here, Dave, and I apologize for interrupting you, but there's a reason when I sent you guys, hey man, send me this information, you know, your bios, and just so you know, I did not list your number of recoveries. I there's a reason I didn't put that, because that is not the definition. Obviously, there comes a point where if you've got your, what do you guys call it, Mitch Care, your homeless dumpster dog or something out there, you know, trying to fake like you're a tracker, recoveries matter. But generally speaking, I don't look at number of recoveries as the indicator of the quality of your dog or the team in general. There comes a point where it has to be a factor. But, you know, to your point, Dave, one of my greatest tracks this year. She was just, I could show you the track line. It's one of the most beautiful things you've ever seen. We didn't recover the deer. I'm 350 legend at 200 yards, probably shoulder shot. I'm certain that deer bred a whole bunch of does after we tracked it, you know, but, you know, great tracking job. Didn't end in a deer on a tailgate. And that's, you know, when I'm counting personal, when I'm counting my numbers, if the deer is not on the tailgate, it's not a recovery. You know, it is not a
recovery. I'm one of those people that my spreadsheet gets bigger every year.
Yeah.
The columns in it, like every year get bigger. Like, cause I want to track, I'm now like mechanical fixed blade, right? Like gun bow, yeah. Right? Like it just,
you just preached. Now, come on, Dave, we're on it. We're running out of time. And you brought up four more topics that we need to cover. Right. I mean, I want to spend time talking about, you know, what are you guys tracking? But we don't have time for that. So Mitch and Kerry, what, any defining moments with Bodark or, Cypress, or you guys in general, defining moments in development. When did you notice a flip of the switch, or are you still waiting?
Let me do hers real quick. Okay. Well, Cypress had one where when we started putting her on tracks, you know, she was 7 months old at the time, and the defining moment for her was with me was when she worked out her first scent pull, and I'm questioning her, but I could tell she's tracking and not searching, and so she's working this area, and I'm like, what is she doing? But then it clicked on me. I'm like, she's working out a scent pull, and she worked it out, and she recovered this deer with no blood, not one drop.
Yep. What
was that?
The dude had shot this little buck with a crossbow.
Oh, yeah.
But he put a field tip on instead of a real broadhead.
Oh, no.
Actually, what it was, it was a broadhead, but the
practice one. His practice broadhead.
Yeah. He had it tied off. You know how some of them you put the little ring over it to keep them from opening? He tied his off with thread.
But anyway, it was I forgot how long the track was, but it was
500 and
she worked out her first scent pull, and I picked up on her doing that, and she went in circles and she worked it out till she figured out where he went. And
where he exited that scent pool.
Yep. Yes, and she went right to him, and I was waiting for confetti to fall out of the sky. I was ready to celebrate, because when she I saw the deer and we was walking up to it, and I'm like, I'm getting all teary eyed, and I'm like, she freaking found it. But her working out her first scent pull this year at 7 months old was a big thing. For me,
that's an awesome one. And before you talk about Bodark, I want to, you know, I absolutely love watching a dog work through a scent pool. I lay scent pools my practice lines just to watch her work through it. She knows how to do it. And in my first recovery, she did a masterful job of working through a scent pool. So that was also a defining moment for me in our year one, on our very first recovery, which was like our fifth or sixth track of our first year. So again, just in the interest of time, I'm not going to bore you with a story. Mitch, what about Bodark? Any defining moment with her?
I noticed something that she did this year that she's never, ever done before. She never did it in her first year. She didn't do it in her second year. But this year she did it three times during the season. Now, you guys, I'll tell you what she did. And you guys tell me if you've ever experienced this with your dogs. But the first time she did it, I was tracking for a guy, I don't know, about a half hour, 45 minutes from here. And we came up to a thicket on a hill, a briar thicket. And it was spotty here and there. We'd have to weed our way through. She hates briars. Mm-hmm. But we got to one spot that was so thick, she couldn't get through it. And I could tell, because she kept backtracking and rechecking her work, then she'd go back to that spot and pace it back and forth. Then she backtrack again, come back to it, start pacing. trying to peek up over it, you know. And pretty soon she just stood up on her back legs. She literally stand up on her back legs and put her head up and sniff. And she go to from left to right, right to left, back and forth.
Yeah.
And she would stand there for a minute or so at a time. She'd get down, walk over a little bit, stand up again, and do the same thing. I said, he went through there. And the guy's like, how do you know? I said, look at the way she's acting. I mean, she was wanting to get in there.
Yep.
So I went ahead and I just jumped on in, tried to flatten those briars down a bit. Boom, she was in, gone. She was on it.
Yep.
From that point on, she weeded her way through the rest of it, and it wasn't too long we found his buck, and it was a good one. And I've seen her do that a couple other tracks, and it's always along the edge of something thick.
Yep.
And I noticed on this one, she actually did that, and all it was tall weeds and, you know, little saplings, but it was pretty thick. And she would stand up, and this time, I think this was the last time she had done it, but she would stand up, and she would sniff the leaves as high as she could get. And it's like she's going from one plant to the next and just keep moving like that.
That's very, very methodical. Yep, Brew would do that too.
Yeah. She literally would turn herself and actually walk on her back legs a few steps. And do it again. And she did that. She covered a good little area like that. And then she got down and off she'd go. She'd get in there and get after it.
She's very methodical.
She's very methodical and meticulous a lot of times.
So what was your defining moment? Standing on her back legs?
Yeah.
That's why I took it. Just when... You know, when she's
I've never seen her do that. Penetrate. Have any of you guys ever seen that?
My partner does it all the time. I always said because he's so small, right? But it's only when we get close to a dead deer. Like if my dog picks its head up and starts, he'll get up on his back legs like that too. And start, if he does that, I'll just drop the leash and I'll turn to the hunter and be like, your deer's here. Like we're not, I don't see it, but it's here. Right. And we're going to be there in a minute. Yeah. Like if he's that close to it's close by at that point.
Right. My dog does the same thing as yours, Dave. I mean, if I'm within 50 yards of a dead deer, Fletcher will start standing up on his back, two legs, work 10 feet, 10 yards, stand up on it and he'll work all his way to the deer. At that point, he's done ground searching. He's wind searching for that deer. Cause he caught a whip on,
right? It's such a big set of pool. Like I should be able to see this with my eyes now. My eyes are better than my nose because the pool is so big. I got to go 30 yards that way to figure out that's the end, and 30 yards that way to figure out.
Yeah.
So he's trying to find it with his eyes almost.
It's either he's dead or he's better than they're alive. He can smell them.
Yeah. To me, you see that that's weird to me because whenever she does it, we're not close to the deer.
Mm-mm. She does it on the track.
She does it on the track. Well,
it sounds like she's doing it just based on what you described. I interpret what you said, Mitch, is she's doing it when there's obstruction. So when there's something that's hard for her to traverse through, you know, she's telling you that this is the way it went by standing on legs and smelling and when waiting for, you know, almost asking for help. Dad, it went here. Can you please mash me a trail? Right. That's or what I got. Yeah, that's what I got when you said that, Mitch. That's a great tell. That's a great tell. Say, okay, man, we just know we got to break that down. Brew will do what you talked about as far as putting your nose on a leaf and a particular sapling. She kept coming back once it was one sapling. I'm like, holy shit, the deer obviously rubbed against it. But nonetheless, if in the interest of time, I'm going to skip over the next without a bunch of conversation because the last two topics I want to cover are going to take up more time than we have left. And they're important, but does everybody do off season training and do you do drags or or tracking shoes, or what do you do?
Yeah.
Which care? What do you get? Do you drag a leg?
I don't do hardly anything. I don't do hardly anything off season at this point until our season opens October 1st. July, I'll pull my bow out and start shooting. The dog gets excited. I'll do a quick track, one maybe in July. Yep. September, start to get him going. But at six, I don't do a lot. I really don't.
A lot of people don't, particularly the veterans. Mitch Carey, what do you guys do?
Basically, what we do when hunting season's over and it's still cool out or cold out, we haven't done it yet, but we'll run tracks back of the house here in the timber. We just use a hoof and maybe an ounce or two of blood, and we'll do anywhere from 400 or 500 yard tracks all the way up to 1600 yard tracks.
We gotta keep them interested, keep them working. Because
I mean, Bodark's not so much of a big deal as it is Cypress right now, because Cypress she needs to work on a lot of stuff still. So.
And they get their leg, you know, they get to keep their leg. We just leave the hoof. So they get to carry it back to the house.
Yep. Yeah, that Brew does too. Brew carries her leg. We play fetch. She gets mad if I don't throw it for her to fetch it. She barks at me all the way. Real quick, Nick, what about you? What's your regimen look like?
Yeah, real quick. I guess I'm going to go real fast on this. As far as starting a dog off, this is what I did. I have my own backpack, a harness, a lead. That's the only time that harness, that lead goes on him is for tracking and training purposes. Yep. So he knows when it's time to actually track a deer. So I put that harness on him, put that lead on him. At the very beginning when I got the dog, I had my wife actually drag a hoof about 3 feet in front of his nose. You know, he's barking at it, yipping at it, like wanting to get it, you know, it's like almost a game, you know, make it fun, then let him play with it a while, and then start a 50 yard track, then an 80 yard track, then a 100 yard track, and I would slowly advance it out. And now I do, I mean, I track in the off season, starting in the spring and through the summer, when I have a deer hoof thawed out in the fridge, which my wife hates. I'll run 3 or 4 tracks a week with that same hoof, and then I'll toss it. But I'll do about a week worth of tracks every month in the summer.
That's cool. Cool. Guys, we got like 10 minutes, and these next topics are 2-hour topics. So let's go around the horn. As concise as you can, what are the top 3 recommendations you have for a hunter post shot? After the hunter makes the shot, or the top 3 things you recommend. Top 3. 1, 2, 3. Top 3 things you recommend for a hunter, as concisely as you can, because the next topic is a top 3 too. Dave.
Pay attention, right? Don't over celebrate. Figure out where that deer went. Like, as far as you can keep an eye on it, keep an eye on it. Calm down. Listen to it.
Yep.
And if you're go home, right? Like, if you shoot a deer in the morning and you don't double lung it, and the thing isn't dead right there, and the arrow you're not sure about, there's no reason to go after that deer in 2 hours, unless, you know, you got commitments or whatever else. But if dead deer doesn't get up and walk away, so give it time, right? As much time as you possibly can. And when you track, mark the friggin' blood trail. Like, and not with your GPS, right? Or a stick or whatever. Just mark your blood trail, right? It really helps out in the end. And I think that's 3.
Yep, it is. Nick.
I'm right there with you. As soon as you shoot, watch the deer's reaction. How did he react after you shot that deer? Where that deer went as far as a visibility marker. Now, if you've seen the deer run across the 200 yards away, out of sight, get down, maybe mark first blood and back out. 2 hours, I say 2 hours minimum, no matter what, but mark the blood, mark the blood, mark the blood, because there's nothing worse than a tracker getting out there and you spend a half hour looking for their last blood or where the blood is at. So that's what I got.
Don't get me started on that one. Mitch and Carey, what's your top 3 recommendations to a hunter post shot?
Mine would be like, take mental note, try to take a mental note of where the deer was standing. We always want to know too what way it's facing. Like Nick said too, the reaction. I want to know the reaction of the deer. You know, and when in doubt, back out. Just if you don't watch it drop, immediately back out. Or if you go to look and you can't find your arrow or anything, or you know, back out.
Yep. But, all great. So go ahead, Mitch.
I was just going to say real quick, back out. Do not grid search.
Oh, there it is. Yep.
Do not grid search and tell the truth.
Oh, tell the truth. So this is good stuff. So I'll give you mine real quick. And it echoes all of this. And again, top three is not enough. But look, man, you know, pay attention. Just as all of you have said, know how that deer reacted, where that deer went. Heed the wait times. Heed the recommended wait times. Wait times is a 30-minute discussion amongst us. We're not going to get into it. But heed the recommended wait times, you know. And then treat the start of every track as if it's a trouble track, as if you're going to have a problem on it by marking the hit site with a high visibility physical marker. That's how I say it, Dave. Rather, you know, you want to use GPS, great, but do that in addition to a high visibility physical marker, not a stick stuck in the ground that looks like every other stick in the ground, not an X scuffed in the dirt. High visibility physical marker. Those are the top three. Pay attention, heed your wait times, treat every track as if it was going to be a trouble track by marking the hit site with a high visibility physical marker. That's what I tell you. And then again, yeah. So here's another top three, and we're down to, you know, let's say 8 minutes. Top three recommendations for new trackers, Nick.
Oh boy, top three recommendations for new trackers. Do your research. Listen to your mentors. And I would say with a young dog starting off, and I didn't listen to this the best, but go on for sure, like more likely tracks where you'll find the deer. Don't take your shoulder shots. Don't take your brisket shots. Go on high recoverable chances to find a deer with that young dog because it'll build confidence with the dog.
Yep. Dave?
Almost exactly the same, right? I think the tracking community as a whole is – I had so many people help me get to where I am in tracking that if anybody calls me up and asks me for help, I'm going to help them. Right. I hope they're not my neighbor because I don't want them stealing my tracks, but anybody other than my neighbor, I'm going to help as much as possible. Right. But you know, reach out to somebody, right. Don't be afraid to reach out. And because I think trackers will help other trackers for sure. And
if they're for the right reasons, they will.
Yep. And the put your dog on as many deer as you can find that you know are dead when they're young, right? Don't expect miracles out of a 8-month-old puppy, and don't believe everything you read on the internet, right? People saying that my 9-month-old puppy went 35 for 36 this season are full of shit.
Yeah. Mitch and Carrie?
I would say like Nick said too, research. I would highly recommend reading John's books and YouTube videos and get involved in the tracking community and learn from the veteran trackers. But don't be afraid to take constructive criticism, you know, and stuff like that.
Yep. That's cool. Mitch?
I would say, like they said, research is everything when it comes to tracking, because when before I started tracking, I always thought it was slap a dog on a lead and take off. No, that ain't even close. Nope. Not even close. So yeah, do your research. Research your dogs. Research your dog.
Yeah, I'll throw my third one in: deer anatomy.
right?
Oh, like, I'm sorry, Dave. I didn't let you get to three.
Yeah, I know, and I didn't think of it until just then. And I'm sorry, Mitch. I didn't mean to cut you off there, but like deer anatomy is a big thing as a tracker, right? Especially if you're going to filter calls, right? If you're just going to answer the phone and go every time you can go, then you're just out there working with your dog. But deer anatomy and understanding what kills a deer is.
I want to add, get ready for emotional trauma.
Yeah.
Distress.
Oh.
Yeah, be prepared for that. The thing you love the most causes you the most pain.
To the lows of the lows. I mean, get ready for that roller coaster ride of emotions.
That's a great one. You know, so again, as we're creeping in on less than 5 minutes now, you know, I'll tell you mine, and is, you know, obviously research, but be patient. Be patient. Patient is key. Patience is not my virtue. I will tell you that. Don't compare yourself to other trackers, particularly the experienced guys. That caused me a whole lot of those lows, Kerry, that you just mentioned. Don't compare yourself. And you have to put in the work. If you want to track and be a credible tracker with integrity, and I don't mean that you're a bad person if you don't put in the work, but in a tracking sense, you have to put in the training early on. Dave, Winston's 6 years old, he's got the game figured out. You don't need to, but early on, new trackers, you do need to put in that work. For the reasons we've talked about, reading your dog, we talked about that a bunch. You got to know your dog to trust your dog. So,
well, you're going to get exactly out of your dog what you put into it.
I think Al Sherman, if you guys all know Al, you can't cheat the grind, and you got to grind that grind.
If you're doing it for the money, if you're going into tracking for the money, I think that's the wrong reason.
If you're going into tracking for the money, I'm going to ask you to not go into tracking. Please don't do it.
That's the wrong reason.
That's the wrong reason, and you're going to end up giving other trackers a bad name somewhere along the way.
Don't say that your dog is this when it's not. You know, don't make your dog be better than what it really is. Don't. We've caught several people in the lie about their dogs.
Well, guys, look, you know, we're 3 minutes out, so this has been super fun. We have more stuff we could talk about for another 2 hours. And I had 9 topics mapped out. We didn't do 3 of them. But, you know, great conversation. Let's stay in touch. Let's share with our text thread, you know, our season, our off training. If we have videos, let's just stay in touch with each other and encourage each other and be fans of each other. And, you know, with that, you know, listeners, I would encourage you to go to Tales on Trails Deer Tracking on Facebook or YouTube to watch this video. It's available on all the common podcast platforms. It will be when I get it uploaded here. But, you know, guys, look, listeners, please be sure to follow Mitch and Kerry Hummel of C&M Big Game Tracking and Recovery out of Oklahoma. Go to their Facebook page, follow them. Matt Davis, Broken Arrow Game Recovery out of Missouri. Please follow him on YouTube and Facebook. Nick Berge, Wounded Whitetails Tracking and Recovery. Please follow him on Facebook and YouTube if you have one, Nick. Dave Mador with us today, Albany, New York. Please follow D&W Tracking Big Game Something Deer Finding Hairy Sausage Dog Dave on YouTube and Facebook. And then Jeremiah Grace, Gracie out of Vermont, Gracie's Tracking Service. Please follow him on his tracking page as well. Guys, it's been a great time. There will be spinoff conversations from this. We will do additional podcasts. But thank you so much for your time. And we are seconds away. So more of the good, less the bad. Talk to you soon. Mitch, real quick.
Matt.
Yep.
Real quick.
Real quick. 30 that's seconds.
Not what our Facebook page isn't under that. It's under Oak Hills Bodark.
I forgot. Oak Hill Bodark. BOISD'ARC. Bodark. Yep. Boyce D. Ark.
Boyce D. Ark.
More the good, less the bad, guys. We got to go. Talk to you soon. Thanks for listening. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.